Hey, it's Jeff Blair, host of the new podcast, Writer's Block. If you're hearing this via your primetime sports feed, follow the link in the show description to subscribe to Writer's Block for more great sports talk and interviews from myself, Richard Deitch, and Stephen Brunt. Writer's Block, sharp takes, not hot takes. Thanks.
Expanding on all of the top sports headlines. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, got a whole lot of hockey talk in Writer's Block today. Nicholas Lidstrom, author of The Pursuit of Perfection, will join us at 2:25, and this is going to be a lot of fun. 3 o'clock, Timo Solani, author of My Life, will join us in studio. We'll chat with Timo about his life in hockey and his book, which, unlike a lot of hockey books, spends a great deal of time covering his career in Finland and giving you a little bit of insight into what it's like to be an NHL player in Finland, from Finland. And as opposed to a lot of books that just kind of start when the player comes into North America. So we're looking forward to that. That'll be at 3 o'clock. Richard Deitch alongside me for Writer's Block. We welcome you. Alexander Ovechkin. You know, this is... I don't know if this is a Toronto thing. I don't know if we could be accused of reading too much into this. It's never a bad thing to read too much into things. I mean, kind of comes with the territory, I guess. But a lot of discussion about something Alexander Ovechkin said today, and a couple of things. We'll play the clip in a minute, but a couple of things as background here. Just had a chance to speak to Jeff Merrick, who, of course, is on before us with Anthony Stewart and Hockey Central. And I think Jeff's right after listening to the clip. I think Alexander Ovechkin's talking more about his experience as a player as opposed to being critical of the Toronto Maple Leafs for the way they approach things and being critical of the Toronto Maple Leafs for the fact that they haven't advanced in the playoffs as far as a lot of people would like them to advance. But one of the things that also needs to be said is Alexander Ovechkin knows all too well what it's like to be considered one of the greatest hockey players of your generation, one of the most dominant hockey players of all time, and not have that Stanley Cup. It doesn't matter how many All-Star nominations you get, how many Hart trophies you get, how many individual accolades you get, without that Stanley Cup as kind of the final thing on your resume, your career is somehow diminished. And Alexander Ovechkin knows better than just about anybody what it's like to start every year facing questions about, is this the year you finally get over the hump? Is this the year you finally win a Stanley Cup? Ultimately, he won his Stanley Cup and kind of slayed that dragon. So I thought what he said today is, it's interesting from that aspect, and that, look, I don't think anybody has come out boldly and said the Toronto Maple Leafs are Stanley Cup favorites this year. Or I don't think anybody's ever come out and said boldly that, you know, the Toronto Maple Leafs there's no way they can't win the Stanley Cup this year. But there have been, for the past couple of years, certainly weight of expectations on this team and weight of expectations on players like Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner, Richard. So I think it's interesting and worth listening to somebody who has been in that position, because quite frankly, if the Leafs do not win the Stanley Cup this year or next year, that's Austin Matthews' position. Lots of money, lots of fame, lots of individual accolades, no Stanley Cup.
Well, the one thing that I was thinking about when I read those comments today, Jeff, was that Alexander Ovechkin now has the authority, I feel like, league-wide to offer that opinion.
Sure he does.
And the one thing, and you hit on it, the one thing that gives you that, I think, is the Stanley Cup. It's very different if Alexander Ovechkin's answering that question as a guy who never won, or at least who didn't lead his team to a victory. It's sort of one thing to, I think, as even Jeff Merrick was telling us before, you know, sort of offering like fatherly advice or senior advice. So I read those comments and I listened to the clip, and I'm sure we'll hear the clip in a little bit. I didn't read those as him trashing the Maple Leafs or Austin Matthews. I thought it was really like it was a thoughtful answer on sort of what kind of journey you have to do as a team to win the cup. And then the second one, this might have been more interesting to me, was the notion of trying to make an offensive player a two-way player and the danger of not, you know, I think what Ovechkin was sort of saying is, you know, with the skill level that he has and a guy like Austin Matthews has, they can improve defensively, but you can't make them into, you know, they're not going to be Bob Gainey. They're not going to be a defensive forward. Ultimately, they're paid to score, which is Ovechkin arguably the greatest of all time behind, you know, whoever, Gretzky or whoever. So I like the fact that he just was willing to talk about these things, Jeff, because a lot of times, you know this, opposing players won't even go there. They will be afraid of becoming a headline in an opposing team's market if they answer questions about the opposing team.
A reminder, by the way, that the Capitals do take on the Leafs tonight, and we've got a pair of tickets to give away to that game, and we'll do that in the 4 o'clock hour, and you'll get a chance to see Ovi and the Capitals in town against the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I you're right, and the topic of discussion in this city in the past week or so has sort of morphed into a discussion on what has to happen for the Leafs to take that next step. And it's against the background of, let's face it, not a good start for this team, a disappointing start for this team. You know, certainly it's early, and certainly no one is going to be writing off the Leafs. But we're already hearing, and this is predictable, we're already hearing discussions about Mike Babcock's job security, and it's in the local press, and it's on social media, and that's fine. That's kind of understandable. I don't think anybody's surprised that a start such as this results in that. But now we're starting to hear, and we talked about it a little bit yesterday, you know, the idea that somehow, I read someplace that Austin Matthews needs to have kind of a Steve Yzerman moment where, you know, he needs to sort of realize that he has to sacrifice individual stats to become a better two-way player. You know, a couple of things about that. First of all, this is a team that is going to live and die in skill. And you've got a general manager who has basically said, we're going to outskill people. He hasn't said we're going to out two-way play people. We're going to outskill people. And I think there's a chance ultimately that Austin Matthews morphs into a good two-way center. I mean, I've heard when he came up, it might have been Jeff Merrick who talked about how, you know, ultimately you look at this guy and he could be an Anze Kopitar, a good two-way player, a guy who's tough to move off the puck, you know, a guy who's defensively responsible. But that it's and I think it's because John Tavares has heard and Mitch Marner's had a slow start, Richard, that now the focus seems to be on trying to get everybody to change. Austin Matthews needs to do this differently. The Leafs need to do this differently defensively. And I'm just not sure that that's in this team's DNA.
Well, for one thing, the idea of trying to sort of make somebody a Steve Yzerman is just silly to me. There's only, you know, you are what you are. Your skill set is what it is. And Austin Matthews is a scorer. He probably will get better as a two-way player. But at the end of the day, like, that's his strength is his offensive, his forte, his offensive skills. And then, you know, again, Jeff, I think when you get off to a slow start, who is the attention going to be on? And this team, it is always going to be on the highest salaried players. All the attention is going to be on Matthews, Tavares, Marner, Nylander, maybe a little bit Riley, maybe a little Tyson Barry. Tavares is out. So like that, the when things are not going well, the chatter in the city, whether it's the media or the fans, are going to be pointing to these guys. As we talked about yesterday in our roundtable, again, I think it is worth just cautioning people. Like, it's still very early in the season. We haven't even seen the full group yet. And if we're having this conversation,
it's very early. It's early.
It's early. Okay, very early. Six games
here now.
Okay, that's fair. Very early. It's early. If we're having this conversation 25, 30 games in, then it's more concerning.
Right.
But it's still early.
This was Alexander Ovechkin today. This is the clip that is getting a lot of airplay, and it will certainly be talked about tonight, I can guarantee you, at Scotiabank Arena as well. Derek, can you play it, please?
For them, you know, they're still a young group of guys, and I hope they're gonna learn. But it's up to them how they wanna do it, and if they wanna play for yourself, or if they wanna win for, if they wanna win Stanley Cup, they have to play differently. It's no doubt.
That was Alexander Ovechkin, and you know, the idea that you have to play for each other, which is seems kind of trite. That would seem to go without saying. But at the same time, I don't think he's necessarily being critical of the Leafs and calling them selfish, because Alexander Ovechkin probably. Well, A, I don't think anybody necessarily goes around passing judgment on another team, but B, quite frankly, I'm pretty certain that he's got enough to worry about that he hasn't done a deep dive into the Leafs. And quite frankly, I don't know if the Leafs are selfish. I just think they are what they are.
Yeah.
And
I don't think of them as a selfish team, do you? Like or the players do not. I mean, I guess, you know, if you have the POV that, like, you don't like the fact when players are trying to get as much money as they possibly can and they're not going to give hometown discounts, but they don't strike me as sort of an individualistic or individual first group of players. And I'm not there every day, but at least from afar, they don't strike me as that.
No, but as I said, again, though, this is all quite predictable given the nature of the start, of the start we've seen from the Maple Leafs it's one thing to say, well, there are other teams in the league that are scuffling. Tampa Bay hasn't necessarily, you know, gotten out to a great start. And I don't know if you can sit and look at any point in this season, will you be able to sit and look at the Leafs and say, and draw a comparison between where they are at that particular time and where they need to be, for example, to beat the Boston Bruins in the playoffs, which is, I think, this is kind of what we're all working towards. But I think maybe what has also happened here with Austin Matthews, Richard, is John Tavares goes out, gets hurt, and everybody says automatically, you know, people have to quote unquote step up. I mean, it's an old sports cliche. It's not just necessarily restricted to hockey. It's every sport. Somebody gets hurt, you need somebody to step up. I think there's an idea that because John Tavares is out, Austin Matthews, as sort of the next dominant center, has to be the guy who sort of assumes a bigger load. And I don't think Austin Matthews' game has been that bad, to be quite honest.
No,
has been quite honest this year. I think the bigger issue for this team is it's play in its own end. And I understand you can say that the forwards are partly responsible for that. That's fine. But more than anything else, it's been the play of their defense in their own end. I just don't think it's been good enough. And as I've talked about, you know, their backup goaltender, their second goaltender, isn't NHL caliber. He's not good enough to be able to win games in the NHL. And you can't look at the Leafs and say they play this way when Freddie Anderson is in goal and it's okay, and then say, well, they got to play this way when Michael Hutchinson is in goal. You can't get them all to change. It's not like they're gonna come out. It's not like they're going to be different players because they have a different guy behind them. It just doesn't work that way. But I think there's my concern here is that the focus is going to get too much on Marner and Matthews and the guys who are drawing the big salary. And, you know, sometimes people have to understand that just because you are making a lot of money and the team isn't playing well, that doesn't necessarily mean your game is at fault. I mean, the easy thing to do is look at the highly paid guys. And I think, look, William Nylander, we expected more from him. Mitch Marner's had a slow start. There's nothing to suggest that Mitch Marner's slow start is going to continue. There's absolutely nothing that hints that it'll be the case. Even if the contract is bugging him a bit, there's nothing to suggest that he's all of a sudden lost the touch. So I think it's predictable that we're having this discussion. But I also find it, you know, this is an interesting time because, again, the Washington Nationals, for the longest time, uber talented, great offensive team, guys making a fair amount of money, chokers.
Yeah, listen, I think when you have a team like this in a market that cares about the team this much, everything is going to be picked upon. But I do think we are in agreement in terms of, I think Austin Matthews is very low on the list of issues at the current moment. Mitch Marner's 5-on-5 play, William Nylander, I think, disappearing in games commensurate to what he's being paid. We certainly know about the defensive issues. Cody Ceci's had problems. Tyson Barrie hasn't been the offensive force that I think people expected. And then last but not least, the backup goalie. And I know it's almost sort of a running joke. You know, why are you talking about the backup goaltenders?
Because the backup goaltenders played in four games so far.
Look at Boston. That would be my answer. Like, look at a team that invested money in almost in a 1A type of backup. It makes a difference. And that's one of the things I want to ask Elliot Friedman about when he comes in is, should the thinking change, like, in the league about how to allocate money, Jeff, for a backup goalie? I realize it is not the perfect parallel, but in a sport like the NFL, like, there are teams that would make a significant investment in a backup quarterback, usually when you don't have a great quarterback. But, like, maybe there's a larger philosophy in terms of money allocation maybe goes there, where in the past a lot of teams just sort of rolled the dice on whoever their number two would be if they have a great number one.
World Series Game 6 goes tonight in Houston. The Leafs host the Capitals. As I mentioned, we've got a pair of tickets to give away in the 4 o'clock hour. We'll do that when Elliot Friedman is with us. But we're going to step away and take a break. When we come back, Nicklas Lidström, author of The Pursuit of Perfection, joins us. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
A big day for hockey on Writer's Block. Timo Salani joins us in studio at 3 o'clock. Elliot Friedman at 4 o'clock. We'll also cover the World Series with Jeff Passan, our MLB insider at ESPN as well. Jeff Passan will be along at 3:30. Game 6 of the World Series goes tonight from Houston, 8 o'clock on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and Sportsnet. The Houston Astros looking to wrap up the World Series, and they win tonight. They will have run the table 4 games in a row after losing the first 2 games at home to the Washington Nationals and what has been essentially a road-dominated series. The title of the book is The Pursuit of Perfection. It is by Nicklas Lidström with Gunnar Nordstrom and Bob Duff. It is a look into the life and career of a hockey player that I don't know if you can possibly describe a player in a more, how would you describe it? In a more laudable way than Mike Babcock describes Nick Lidström. And I'm just going to read this before we bring Nick on. This is Mike Babcock. He's the best player I've ever coached by far. He was absolutely beyond professional. How can you do everything right all the time? I've never seen anyone like him. Nick drove the bus. In my mind, his steadying force was instrumental. Never mind his skill level, just who he is as a man. Obviously, he was a gifted athlete who read the game as good as anybody and played in all situations. He was really important for us. And when your best defensive defenseman is your best offensive defenseman, I think it helps because you get the puck going. His everyday professionalism and the modeling he did for the rest of us and how he carried himself, how well he played, how hard he practiced, how good of a fitness level he maintained was an example to everybody. Nick Lidström joins Richard Deitch and myself. That's pretty high praise from a coach, Nick. And I'll ask you this. You know, now that you've had a chance to sort of step back and look at your career, how difficult was it to maintain that level of day-to-day commitment and day-to-day performance over, you know, the long term, a very long NHL season?
It was a little bit different, but my approach was always, you go to work every day, whether you're working in a grocery store or you're doing something else, you go to work every day, and that's the way I approached it too. And I know it only took me maybe 2 to 3 hours a day to do my job, and I wanted to do it as good as I could. But also some nice kind words from Babs, that's for sure.
Nick, is Mike Babcock easy or difficult to play for, and why?
No, he could be difficult because he's a demanding coach. He wants us his way. And as a player, you have to buy into the system. But I didn't find it overly difficult to play for him. I played for Scotty Bowman, and he was a demanding coach as well, maybe in a different way. But they were both demanding coaches, but they had a lot of success. They've had a lot of success over the years as well. So you buy into that as a player.
Nick, what does a player have to do to earn Mike Babcock's trust? You talked about sort of at times he could be tough, but clearly there's a standard that he wants. So what does a player have to do for Mike Babcock to believe in him?
I think it starts with work ethic and, putting your best foot forward and trying your best and not show up at work every third day or have every third game you're one of the best players on the ice. Stay more. So Babs knows what to expect from you. He knows what he can get from you, and I think that work ethic is could be number one because he wants you to work all the time. And after when you've done that, you go home and feel good about yourself because you've done everything you could. But I think work ethic starts right there.
You talk about work ethic, Nick, but a lot of that also isn't just it's not just on the ice, but it's also in the in terms of your conditioning. And, covering you a little bit in your career, I always tell people that one of my most memorable experiences was going into the Detroit Red Wings locker room during the playoffs towards the end of your career. And you'd look around and the scars, the beaten up guys in there, and you'd just go, God, these guys just look like they've been through the meat grinder. But you guys all, you all logged incredible minutes of ice time right up to the end of your career. Nobody took a night off. What was it about that group in terms of your physical conditioning? Not just you, but that group, Nick, that was so good.
I think it starts, when I joined the Wings, we had Steve Yzerman as our captain. He kind of set the tone for the work ethic off the ice, in the weight room, on the bike. When you have your best players putting all the extra work in, the young guys and the other players will follow. And I think we had that great culture in Detroit. And I tried to kind of take over when Stevie was done, and I had Sederberg and Datsyuk with me as well, who were guys that put that work in. And I think that's what it started for me when seeing Stevie being one of the leaders and seeing one of the hardest workers on the team. I think that sets a great example for the other team or the other players to follow.
Nick, why'd you decide to write a book now?
I've been asked when I was still playing if I wanted to do something like this, and I always pushed it aside and didn't give it much thought. But I got approached again a couple years ago, and finally I decided to. It would be fun to put everything in writing and try to remember all the good things and some of the bad stuff and some of the tough losses as well, and put that into a book and document my career. And it's been a lot of fun. I had a good help from Gunnar Nordstrom and Bob Duff to go over this, but it was a lot of fun just reflecting on my career in that matter.
Nick, the Red Wings, in addition to having a lot of really good Swedish players, of course, they cornered the market on Russian players as well. What was it about that organization, looking back at it now, do you think made it so open to European players?
I think they had some of the scouts working in Europe back in the 80s. They had Christer Rockström, who was working for the Wings at the time. He saw myself play, Konstantinov, Fedorov. He saw these players play, and they were looking for a way to, especially the Russian players, to bring him over. It wasn't easy when it was Soviet Union back then, but somehow they knew they had talent there. They knew not many teams had been over there and kind of gotten players out of there. So the Wings were one of the first ones to be able to to bring players over from Russia, and they, you know, they find some great players in both Konstantinov and Fedorov, even Kozlov was the guy we had who was young players coming over. So they were always one of the first teams over there scouting players and kind of on the eastern side of Europe.
Nick, you know, sort of the follow up on Jeff's point, the thing about those Red Wings teams is they were tight and they were a group of players from all over the globe. Is there, from your experience in the NHL, did you learn how a group of people from different countries, different places could come together for the common goal?
Yeah, no, we had a good mix of some young players, some talented young players, and some veterans that's been around. But I think the key for those teams were that we were able to gel as a team. We didn't have cliques of Europeans going out for dinners at one place, and the Canadians at one place, and the Americans. We all gelled together, and I think that shows the success we had as a team, because we gelled so well as a team, and we stuck up for each other too. You know, Darren McCarty would back up Konstantinov if something happened to him, or Larionov or Fetisov. We had guys standing up for one another, and it didn't matter if you're European or North American. We all were on one team. I think that was a big part of us having so much success, especially in the 90s. Mm.
What was the highlight for you, Nicholas, when it was all said and done? What do you look back at, and what are you proudest of the most?
Looking back must be the Stanley Cup wins. Because you set up the goal in September in training camp to reach a goal. You know, you have Ken Holland or Scotty Bowman showing you a picture of the Stanley Cup, and this is our goal. And then you go through a whole season, the whole journey of playing 80-plus games, and then the playoffs, and then you reach that goal. That's, you know, that's the ultimate price. There's so many teams battling for playoff spots or you know, even, you know, to make the playoffs. But when you reach that goal of winning the Stanley Cup, that's the ultimate prize.
Nick, in the book, you talk about how 4 or 5 years ago you met with some scientists who were doing a study on hockey intelligence. And so they used you and your game to sort of get some data. What did they find about your game regarding your hockey intelligence?
Well, when they approached me, they wanted to kind of pick my brain and see how I was thinking the game in different game situations, whether it's coming down to 2-on-1 against me or going out in the corners playing a 1-on-1 battle. They wanted to kind of pick my brain and see how I was thinking in these different situations. And they were able to put a mathematic formula into this, which was really, you know, fantastic to watch, and really something I haven't been part of before. But it was fun to do, because they really looking at the pros and cons of winning a battle in different areas at the rink. If you lose a battle in the slot or in the corner, you know, there's a grade A scoring chance, it's not as big scoring chance. They were able to break that down and explain it to me. And then they used me as an example of the way I play the game, which was, you know, very fascinating to go through.
So, Nick, I want to expand on that. Obviously, not every NHL player can be Nick Lidstrom. You're in the Hall of Fame for a reason. But when you get to hockey intelligence, do you think that is something innate, essentially something that players are born with, or can it be somehow taught, even though the game itself is very fast and you'd be making these decisions and processes in very fast real time?
I think you have to have some sort of hockey IQ at the bottom, in the beginning, or kind of on the ground. But I think you can develop that by you know, teaching different areas of the game, by watching tapes of different situations. I think you can learn if you're able to adapt to different situations. You can learn a lot from watching videos or doing different practice drills to bring that level up a little bit. So I'm positive that you can enhance that by watching video and things like that.
Nick, you know, if you talk to former coaches in any sport, if you talk to coaches in any sport, they always talk about how one of the keys, it might seem kind of odd, but one of the keys to being able to think fast during the game is slowing the game down. You often hear, you know, you hear it a lot in sports where the game, the good players are able to slow the game down, or at least sort of control the speed of the game. How much of what you were able to do came from that ability? You know, did you ever get the sense that you know, the game was too fast for you?
The game was fast. I didn't think it was too fast for me, but I had that same feeling that the way you're describing it, that I could waiting for a player to jump in a hole by hanging on to the puck a little bit longer, just reading plays that's going to develop here in a second or two if you can just hang on to the puck. That's something that I was able to do. I was able to, in my mind, I was able to slow the game down to knowing, you know, when a play is going to happen or anticipating a play that's going to happen. And I think that's the best way to describe this, that you kind of slow the game down, even though it's still going 100 miles an hour. You can still kind of slow it down in your brain to see that things are going to develop.
Nick, how often do you get a chance to see the Maple Leafs play?
Not that often. I've watched some highlights, and just from a distance, being in Sweden, I followed what happened with Nylander last year, and holding out and starting in the last 5 minutes or whatnot, and same thing this summer. So I, just from a distance, I watched them, and just knowing that they have high power offense, a lot of skilled guys up front, guys that can score, that plays with a high pace. So that's probably as much as I've seen so far.
Nick, it was great of you to join us. Thanks so much. Congratulations on the book.
All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on, guys.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you. Nicklas Lidström, The Pursuit of Perfection by Nicklas Lidström with Gunnar Nordstrom and Bob Duff, the longtime and really good hockey writer with the Windsor Star, who spent a lot of time around those great Red Wings teams. And I cannot, you know, you look at Nick Lidstrom's career, played, Scotty Bowman called him one of the most perfect players he had. Mike Babcock called him one of the most perfect players he had. But you look at those Red Wings teams, and you know, you brought up the point, and it was a great point about the ability to take all those players from different nationalities and meld them together in a group, you know, in pursuit of a common goal. And the thing people need to remember about hockey teams that are put together like that is a lot of these guys would be opponents, whether it was in the Olympics or the World Championships. And, you know, anybody who's covered international hockey will tell you, Sweden versus Finland, some of those games, they could get nasty. And it's always intrigued me how a coach gets players who are probably at some point, or probably at some point, because they've been so good, they're so good, they've represented their countries at elite competitions, they've probably faced the other elite players. And if they're their teammates, it's always amazed me how coaches are able to kind of pull everything together. And yeah, money has a lot to do with it. I think the fact that, you know, you're professional athletes, you're getting paid, and if we're all successful, we all get paid. But the ability to sort of overcome those natural barriers is something that I have always been amazed at, how coaches, especially in hockey, are able to do that.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that team really was like the United Nations, basically, with those Russians and Swedes. The thing is, and this is, Jeff, this is just interesting to me because this is the history of coaching. You know, Mike Babcock is a genius when he has Nick Lidstrom. He's not as much of a genius if he has Tyson Barrie. And, like, it does sort of let you know how great this guy in particular was, because it just makes your life that much easier. Not only, obviously, was he a great player, but he seemed to be the focal point of an international team, and everybody respected
that. Well, and your question to him about that study, having your ability. I mean, just think about what that says. That academic people
use him as the guy.
Want to study how you processed your job, which is what it was. How you processed your job. They want to study it and try to put some sort of mathematical formula to it. You know, it's always, I remember the days when I'd cover F1 for the Montreal Gazette, and you would talk to people around F1 teams, and part of the training they would do, they do the hand-eye, the coordination training that fighter pilots do in Europe. They would take them over. There was, I can't remember the name, there was a training center in France. But essentially what they were doing is they were trying to have F1 drivers process information the same way fighter pilots do.
That's cool.
And it's just the idea that you see a game and think a game so well that people would want to study you has got to be the ultimate compliment for
him. And again, I this is just my own sort of thesis, but it does seem like Swedes and Finns feel the game differently.
Yep.
Oh. Maybe Russians too, then North Americans. It's not to say they're better, and it's not to say North Americans can't win, but you know what I'm saying? There's like, I don't know if it's like the same premise of like the kid who grows up in a poor part of Spain or Portugal and just feels like soccer. Mm-hmm. It's just like there's certain countries that they just have an innate sense of the game when it comes to hockey. And like Sweden, Finland, Russia, always.
Yeah, I've always wondered. Russia's not necessarily the example, but well, you know, we'll be joined by Timo Salani later, and maybe we can ask him this, but I've always wondered if perhaps the fact that Sweden and Finland, that geographically the population center tends to be a little closer than Canada, that does that make it a little easier to identify? I know John Herdman
all the great players play against each other's
exactly.
Kids.
John Herdman talks about identifying Canadian soccer players, and he's made the point that you have to just assume that regardless of how well you do your job, you may not get that kid in Saskatoon who could be a phenomenal soccer player just because the country's so damn big.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to pull that, whether it's a male or female soccer player. You're not going to be able to pull that person out of there because it's just so big. And I wonder if maybe that's sort of that geographical compression, if you want to call it that,
right,
may or may not have something to do with it. But, a great interview. I'm looking forward to the book. He was a splendid hockey player to watch. And as I said, that is the theme for today's show. Timo Salani will join us at 3:00. We'll take a break, be back with more Writer's Block on 590 and 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Make up your mind.
All right, Timo Salani will join us at the top of the hour. It's Blair and Deitch, Writer's Block. This just broke a couple of minutes ago. I don't know who had it first. I don't know if it's CNBC. I have no idea who had it first. But the NCAA is going to allow athletes to profit from their name, image, and likeness in a major shift for the organization. This will essentially, Richard, start the process of allowing student athletes to profit off of the use of their faces, their images. Now, a little bit of background here. The state of California, this has been a long-standing, I mean, we're not talking about athletes being paid salaries here. We're talking about athletes being rewarded for organizations being able to use their likenesses to make money. So it's not necessarily part and parcel of the same discussion, but the state of California earlier this year passed a motion giving athletes the right to profit off the use of their images. The state of Florida followed, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, last week, or it was tabled in the state of Florida. So clearly you got California, you got Florida, two of the most high profile states for college athletics, opening the door to this. The NCAA has now, agreed to go along with this. A little bit of a caveat, though. The specifics for how the compensation will be meted out is going to fall on each of the NCAA's three divisions to craft their own rules, which I guess that kind of makes sense because there is such a difference in economics between Division I, Division II, and Division III that you really can't have a one-size-fits-all thing, can you?
Not just that. Major difference even in Division
in
I,
sports.
Jeff. Yeah, power. There's like, you know, they have like the power conferences and then
right,
even the lower tier Division One, this is a long time coming, but two, I think the NCAA saw that they were going to ultimately lose this
right,
case in court.
Well, again, if California and Florida are sort of lining up against you,
exactly,
your line of defense, shall we say, has already been breached, hasn't it?
And the other thing too could be that the NCAA is a organization made up of all these colleges around the country. You don't want two states to have a massive advantage, right, in recruiting.
Oh, my God, no.
Which is what would have, I think, ultimately what would have happened in that. We're talking about the best of the best, the Zion Williamson types.
Yes.
Why wouldn't you play for UCLA in that case, right, if you can make a deal with a, I don't know, a car dealership?
So this is more greedy self-interest than altruism.
Like yeah, exactly. That said, I think it's great, and this is not going to be, not every single American college student, Canadian college student who is in the States is going to get paid, but a lot of them are.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I'm really happy about, this doesn't get said enough, Jeff, is forget about college football and college basketball. People like Katie Ledecky, it's the Olympic athletes like Kylie Moss, can now basically make money and keep their eligibility in college, where before, too many of them had to make a choice, basically, if they wanted to be a college student, if they wanted to get an education, they could not profit off their athletic greatness, which in something like swimming is between 18 and 23.
Right. That's when you're in school for the most part.
So I think that, to me, I'm really happy for the Olympic athletes, at least the upper echelon ones who can now get paid.
Right.
And deservedly so.
And the news story also goes further and says the moves come after the NFLPA, the National Football League Players Association, and National College Players Association announced Monday they were going to explore ways to ensure the college athletes get a share of revenue stemming from the sale of their name, image, and likeness. So, I mean, Richard's right. It's
by the way, in the ranking of horrible, FIFA, IOC, NCAA, in that order, IOC, FIFA. Who's worse at that group?
Wow. I mean,
they're all axis of evil.
Yeah, I tend to think that FIFA and IOC are probably in a different level.
You're right.
Just because you can look at the NCAA and go, they're stupid-ass Americans. But FIFA and IOC, there's a degree of international complicity at work there that crosses borders. But again, I think at some point, I don't know how you feel, Richard, I think at some point we are working towards, if not necessarily the idea that athletes get paid, I think we are working towards the idea that, you know, for example, if you are a college athlete, you should be able to have a job that pays you. You know, the idea is a great point that, God, I can't believe I'm quoting Warren Sapp, but I believe it was Warren Sapp made the point on NFL Network that, look, here's the thing. If you're a college quarterback and you blow your knee out in a college game, you got no insurance. If you're the dude selling the hot dogs in the stands and you burn your hand, you get workman's comp. And I that's not to denigrate the guy selling the hot dogs. But what I'm saying is there's a real sort of, there's always been an odd dichotomy there in that people are making money off people who aren't being paid. You know, that's generally not where you want to go.
I can't believe Warren Sapp made such an astute point,
it was Warren Sapp.
I tip my hat to him. The one thing that, Jeff, that is always, this is so typical NCAA, and the college basketball commentator, Jay Billis.
Sterling Sharp. Got my players mixed up.
Jay Billis always sort of on Twitter puts out whenever one of these new, whenever a college football, a college basketball program shows you like their $1 billion, clubhouse or $1 billion weight room, he'll always say there's no money. Like that's sort of his running joke. And this is a perfect example. Finally, the people who actually produce the revenue are at least going to see a little bit of the money. Now, it's not going to be, I think you're right. I think we are heading towards some kind of pay for play. I don't know exactly what that'll be, but this is a good first step. Yeah. They should own their image. That's who, you know, that is in every other facet of life. You own your image. These kids should own it too.
Yeah. It's been a long time coming. And as I said, it's just, I think it's the initial breach of the defenses.
Agreed.
And it will certainly, if nothing else, Richard, it'll certainly give momentum and hope, you know, to people like the Ed O'Bannons of the world who have made the cause of college athletes getting some sort of compensation, you know, have made it an important part of their life's endeavor.
You know, when he was great at UCLA, he's not able, you know, the great thing about a guy like Ed O'Bannon is his sacrifice is going to make someone else wealthy, not necessarily Ed O'Bannon.
No, that's the thing. This is, it's a good day, frankly. And
I agree.
It's a good day for college athletics in the United States, a good day for college athletics in general. And as Richard pointed out also well, you know, we're not just talking about the football players who are going to make millions and millions of dollars or the basketball players to make millions and millions of dollars in the pros. We're talking about the gymnasts. We're talking about the swimmers. We're talking about the people whose peak of their athletic career and what should be the peak of their earning and marketing power comes from there.
But like college. An Andre, like one of our track guys goes to American college, they cannot get paid.
Absolutely. The book is My Life. It is written by Tim Lasalani. He joins us, Writer's Block, on 590 and 360.
Unconfirmed sources say this is the best show in the history of sports radio.
You're simply the best.
This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch.
Better than all the rest.
On Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Game 6 of the World Series goes tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and Sportsnet as the Astros look to wrap up the World Series. I think they'll get it done tonight. Steven Strasburg on the mound, though. He's 4-0 with an ERA of 1.93 in the postseason for the Washington Nationals. Justin Verlander, 1-3 with an ERA of 4.15 in the postseason. Tom Verducci of SI, in his look, his notebook, revealed something that shocked me. Justin Verlander has not won a World Series game. You know what? Because we're so used to...
Really?
I'm going to call up Verducci's.
How is that possible?
Well, his team's won.
Yes,
but I mean, he doesn't...
He's had no decisions?
Here we go. Here we go. Okay, this is... Verducci, by the way, is... I mean, I just...
greatest.
I look at his writing and I weep. Justin Verlander has won Rookie of the Year. He's won the Cy Young Award, MVP. He's got the no-hitter. He's a 20-game winner, 300 strikeouts. He's a world champion. He does not have a World Series win. Most World Series starts without a win. Now, granted, this is not bad company. Most World Series start without a win. Don Newcomb.
Wow.
5. His record was 0-4. His ERA was 8.59.
Oof.
This one blew me away because this is when I started watching baseball, and I would have gone to my grave swearing that this guy was one of the best big game pitchers of our time. Vita Blue, 0-3 in 5 starts, an ERA of 4.05. And he pitched for those really good athletics teams. Justin Verlander, 6 starts, 0-5. 5.73 ERA. Wow. Like it's odd how you get these stats. And then you go back and you look and you go, yeah, actually Justin Verlander's had some not brilliant starts in the World Series. But to see those numbers there, the idea that Justin Verlander is attempting to win his first World Series start is absolutely blows me away.
I'm sure you don't have the stats off the top of your head, but in AL Championship Series,
no idea.
It's probably reversed, right? You would think he'd be, or
I have no idea.
That would be my sense because he doesn't strike. I don't have him in my head as a bad postseason pitcher.
Well, I don't know if he's not a bad postseason pitcher because
he's
got wins.
0-5.
But he's not. Yeah. No, but I mean, he's not. You know, and that kind of reveals the sort of irrelevance in some ways of wins and losses as a stat for pitcher, but. Yeah, he has not been dominating in the World Series.
Interesting.
And, you know, it gets to the point. At his age, the innings start to mount up and going, you know, pitching all those innings in season and then carrying it over into the postseason is not necessarily easily done. But that number just blew me. And I don't even know Don Newcomb's ERA. I mean, that's... before my time. I mean, he must have had some real stinkers in there. But Vida Blue just crushes me. Vida Blue was... I was never an Oakland Athletics fan.
But that team is so great, though.
They're so
Catfish
good. I mean, the
Hunter,
white shoes, they had Catfish.
Blue Moon
Joe
Odom.
Joe Rudy. Reggie Jackson was there. Blue Moon Odom. Yeah. Raleigh Fingers.
Oh, yeah, Raleigh.
Those are my, you know... That's actually... They and the Big Red Machine are kind of the first... dynastic baseball teams when I really started getting into baseball. I guess I probably would have been 12 or 13 when I really started getting into it. And those were the guys.
They played against you. The Reds and the A's played.
They
in
played
one of
against each other.
Like 74 or something like that?
I don't know about 74. I know they played against each other once.
Okay.
At least
And I know
once.
The A's played the Mets once. I remember that.
Right. And
73, I think.
And I've got a brain fart who the other World Series.
And then the Reds, Red Sox is that famous one in 75.
Yes.
But the A's must have won another. They win in 72? Sounds like, did they win three, they won, you know, three in a row or two or three?
Two or three in
something
a row.
Like
and then they came back to win. Of course, when they,
and then
when Tony La Russa managed.
Who's that owner?
Charlie O'Finley.
Oh, he tried to sell everybody.
Oh, he did. Yeah. And then he basically forced the commissioner to step in. And the Charlie O'Finley stories are freaking legendary. But they had, the Oakland Athletics have just had such good pitching. You go through their franchise, they had I mean, they had that staff when they had Rick Langford.
Right.
And they had...
What's that, like, Billy Martin staff? Mike Norris. Remember that
number? Mike Norris, an obscene number of complete games.
Right.
Like, just obscene. If you throw those numbers out to guys now, they'd start puking. I think at one point, if I'm not mistaken, I did a documentary. I think Rick Langford had like 15 complete games in a row.
Yeah, I mean, Billy Martin, he killed those guys. So that's interesting, Jeff, because like that franchise has such a great history, yet
it's so bad. It's
nowhere now.
It's nowhere.
Like, no one goes to those games. It's crazy because they should be like a lovable Chicago Cubs like franchise.
Absolutely.
But they're not, though.
Absolutely.
I don't know if it's because the stadium is crap or the location, but like the history of the A's is unbelievable.
The stadium is garbage.
You've been there. Oakland, Alameda?
Been there many times.
Okay, I've never been there.
It's garbage. It is such garbage that I like going there.
I
consider Fenway to be garbage, and I don't like going to
disagree.
Fenway.
I don't like going
to Fenway. But that could be a product of the city more than anything else. Yeah. I think Boston's a hugely overrated city. But, Oakland, you get off the BART train, the bridge crossing over to get to the ballpark. You used to go through over something called the Western Colloidal or something like that, and all I remember is there's this big pit of black goop, and it would just bubble. You'd look down, and you hear boop. It's
amazing. And again, like we're talking about the great 70s era. Like they had that era with La Russa, Maguire, Canseco. That they were incredible, those teams.
Yeah, they were.
Eckersley.
Yeah.
I mean,
they were the gateway for a lot of the
I know the Dodgers won that series, but I'm not saying they didn't cheat, but like that they're a fascinating franchise to me.
Yeah.
And then you have the Billy Beane era, and like Moneyball and everything else,
the thing about the Oakland Athletics is you're right. They should be a lovable embrace.
They're the opposite.
Team.
They're like they have no fan base.
Yeah.
And they want out.
They want and a lot of it I think comes from, you know, what we've seen lately with Billy Beane is just the idea that you're the smartest kid in the class, and that kind of rubbed some baseball people the wrong way, but God love them. Anyhow, so Justin Verlander tonight looking to break that postseason drought.
But you think it's over even with his record.
I want to think it's over because I'm just about ready for the World Series. I mean, we've seen everything we need to see. We've seen Donald Trump gets booed, so it gets booed. It can end now, and stuff will have been accomplished. But I don't know, man. It's weird. Now that I'm thinking of Justin Verlander's record, I'm wondering, you know.
What would Game 7 be? Scherzer is a game-time decision?
Scherzer's a game-time
decision.
And the
Astros would be Greinke?
I think it would be Greinke
and anybody who's available.
Yeah. You know, and that's where it gets interesting. Garrett Cole, you're 5 days away from becoming a free agent and probably making $250 million. Do you want to risk going out there throwing an inning of relief?
Of course, I
think Garrett Cole will. But anyhow, that's what if you're a Nationals fan and you're looking for something to hang your hat on, after seeing your team get pasted at home and manage a run a game, well, there's something you can hang your hat on. The fact that Justin Verlander has hardly been a beast in the World Series. And some of us would look at that and say he's due.
Yeah.
But it's funny that doesn't always work that way. Generally, when a guy is scuffled at this point in the season in his career, you can just declare it a trend.
No great genius here. I feel like if the Astros get a lead, that lead early, that game is over. But I now have much more interest in the game, Jeff, after you told me that stat. Because I just would have presumed, and I think most sports fans just would have been like, oh, Verlander, he must be like, you know, lights out in World Series. But he's not.
Yeah.
Good on Verducci to get us that stat.
It is. Anyhow, so there you go. As I said, if you're looking for something to hang your hat on.
Timu, I think, is coming soon. I believe he's taping in a studio near us.
I must be taping 31 Thoughts.
31 Thoughts,
because there's a Friedman. Oh, Travis is striding over to the microphone. Mm-hmm. He's going to tell us. Yes. They are just wrapping.
Just wrapping up.
Then we'll be joined by Timu Solani.
Is there anything we can ask Timu that would be change up from 31 Thoughts, guys? I think so.
Oh, yeah. I can ask him about Winnipeg.
I know. I'm excited about you two reminiscing.
Well, I'll make it sound like we're
your pals.
Friends.
But you know, you probably both visited some of the haunts in Winnipeg, same haunts in Winnipeg, right? No?
There's only two. So, yeah, my guess is probably. I probably couldn't use the back door to get in. Well, the one place I could use the back door to get in. That's not entirely true. We're looking forward to being joined in a few seconds by Timo Solani once he finishes wrapping up with the 31 thoughts. Boy, hopefully they're at least on their 29th thought by now. Hopefully they're at least in their 29th.
That's the flagship podcast, though. You
know, yes, it is. Passan joins us at 3:30. We'll talk to him.
He did really good work on the Astros. He's written some great pieces, Jeff, this week.
Elliot Friedman at 4 o'clock once he's finished. We'll talk to Elliot about the panic in Leafs Nation. Matt Devlin, Raptors play-by-play voice, joins us at 4:25. The Raptors managed to stay awake long enough to beat the Magic 104-95 last
night. That
was
a good game, Jeff. I actually enjoyed watching that because they were really blowing them out early and then let the Magic come back in, and then it became a very, I thought, interesting fourth quarter.
Magic are kind of a fascinating team.
They're going to be good. Because, I don't know when, but good, but eventually.
Yeah, I think you're right. I have all sorts of respect for Jeff Weltman, their general manager. And Steve Clifford is one of the game's really, really good coaches. And they will. I mean, I've got them down. I think not only are they a playoff team in the East, I think they're a team that's going to be capable of knocking off somebody
this year.
Yeah.
Oh, so you like them developing?
They played that first game. Now, granted, the Raptors had that first game hex going, but they really had the Raptors figured out in the first game
last year. I agree.
They've got some really good players. I love Aaron Gordon. You know, a guy who's gone from being in some ways a one-trick pony to being a really good, complete NBA player. Not to mention a really good interview as well. I'm a big fan of that team, and they are not going to be a pushover this year. And Kyle Lowry, you know, there are games that demand Kyle Lowry to be the best player on the court. And the number of times, and I think you know what I mean by this.
That happened in the finals, by the way.
The number of times, and this is what doesn't frustrate me anymore because they're champions, but used to frustrate me about people talking about Kyle Lowry. The number of times that guy answered the bell in game when you need him to make a play. I just don't think he ever got enough credit for that. Last night was another one of those games where you needed him.
You really needed him. Having now lived here for a year and a half, the thing, Jeff, and you've seen Kyle Lowry a lot more than I have, the thing that you really appreciate about Kyle Lowry are some of these things that don't appear in the box score. For instance, he is the best point guard I have ever seen at taking charges for his size. He's unbelievable. And here's another thing. The guy guards people so much bigger than him sometimes in the post, and he defends them into taking or making poor decisions.
Yeah.
Like, that is a great skill. No doubt there are times when he's a little out of control. His shooting is very inconsistent. But he does these things during games, again, that, like, do not get – they're not points necessarily or rebounds or assists, but they're winning plays. And I think if you watch Lowry on an 82-game basis, you see that every night. And last night was a perfect example of they were in trouble in the fourth quarter, and he essentially willed them to that win. Eventually the Magic folded, but – That win goes to, in my opinion, goes to him, a little bit to Pascal as well. But I think I'm a little different than you in that, yeah. I find them interesting this year, but I still don't know exactly what they are.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that.
Good to see you.
Timo Solani joining us in studio. Timo, thanks for joining us. Make sure you get the book up here so everybody can see. So there's two people in this room who spent time in Winnipeg. Whereabouts did you live when you were in Winnipeg? Which part of the city?
River Heights.
Okay.
Campbell Street.
All right.
Great place.
There you go. That's my wife's family's from Charleswood. So we got that out of the way now. We got that.
I'm just going to sit back and let you guys reminisce. Out of the way.
Congratulations on the book, Timo. You know what I found really fascinating about this? A lot of people write books about their career. A lot of hockey books that are written about their career don't go into as much detail about the career in Europe as you do in this book, your career in Finland. Now, I know the book was out in Finland first, correct?
Yeah.
But how important is it, do you think, that North American audiences get a sense of what it's like to be a hockey player coming from Finland?
Yeah, I thought that it's going to be interesting, maybe, North American people to to hear what kind of background we are coming from and what the journey has been until we come here. You know, everybody knows what happened after when you come here, but mm-hmm. I think hopefully it's going to be interesting to people to realize like what kind of life and what it took to come here and what has happened during the way.
So you wrote this book in 2014. It came out in Finland then. Why now? Why the decision to publish that in Canada and in North America 2019?
Well, I thought I'm going to only do the Finnish version first. And I was not even thinking about coming out with the English version. But little by little, people start talking, why you don't do that in English, you know? And little by little, I start thinking, maybe I should do, you know? And then we decided we're going to come out here. And I think it was a nice decision, you know? It's something what last forever, you know, and I know that a lot of fans are excited to read that, and it's a piece of history.
It's funny. We just had Nick Lidstrom on a little bit earlier, and I was telling Nick that I used to marvel when I covered hockey and I'd go into the Red Wings dressing room during the playoffs, and you'd see all these guys scarred up. And I said to Nick, it was a bunch of old guys that looked really scarred up and had just been through the battles. But one of the things I also remember about, and I tell people this, I don't know if I've ever gone into a room full of older athletes who were as athletic looking. You're the same way. Like you're still obviously in good shape. What was the key to maintaining that level of athleticism late in your career?
Well, that was the big challenge for me too. You know, I was almost 44 when I retired, and the older you get, you know, you have to start pay attention to little details, how you rest and how you eat and all the massages and how you recover faster, because it's when you play 3-4 times a week and then you travel, you know, it's you can't compete with that with the almost half
sure.
your age kids, you know. So you know, it was but when you do things smart and you discipline, you do the right things, you have a chance, but it's not easy, you know. That's why I'm very proud that I could play that, you know, like late age, you know, as a hockey player, you know, it gave me a lot of satisfaction.
What I'm always fascinated by, what is unique or what characteristics are unique to a country. What, in your opinion, what is unique to, what is a Finnish player? What is unique about a Finnish player, let's say, versus a Canadian player, a United States player, a Russian player?
Well, I think the Finnish players are very hardworking guys, and they believe discipline, and if they ask you something, they will do it, and I think that has been a trademark for the Finnish players, and I think we're quite easy with adjust the new roles, and that's why I think that's a big strength in the national games when we go to Olympics and World Championships. You don't. Whatever role they give it for you, you try to do that as good as you can, and that's why we have had so much success. But a lot of times the Finnish personality is a little bit like tight and a little maybe shy and private. But I don't know if that's a culture thing. But like myself, I'm totally opposite, so I don't feel that I'm a Finn like that way.
I remember when Dave King was coaching over in Europe. One of the points Dave King made to me was, he said, there is only one other country whose players come together on the national team the way Canada does. He said, the Finns and Canadians are the same. The national team, everybody wants to play for the national team. But he said, there's something about putting on that Finnish jersey that he said makes guys who are good players just go to that that other level. There really is a sense of pride and camaraderie amongst Finnish
players,
isn't it?
I think the Finns are like Canadians. Like hockey is the biggest thing, and play for your own country, it's just a huge thing. You know, I always remember when I was 16 and I really put that jersey first time on. I still remember the feeling, like how proud mm-hmm. feeling you have, and it lasts forever. You know, it's something that, you know, you take a lot of pride and that's why I said, like, when you go to the national team and the coach had you in the fourth line, even you think you should be in the second line, you do the fourth line role and you do that as good as you can. And we always try to remind everybody that I don't care if you play 2 minutes or 20 minutes. I need your best 2 minutes in your life, you know. And mm-hmm. and the guys was accepting that. And that's why we had all the success.
You were captain of the team in Sochi, correct?
Yes.
That's not so far ago, five years ago,
yeah,
right?
5 years
ago. So you would have been 42, something like that?
No, I was almost 43.
43,
yeah.
Playing in the Olympic Games, captaining. As great as your career was, that must have been an unbelievably prideful accomplishment to one, get a medal, but two, to lead that team at your age, an age which, you know, other than like Gordie Howe and a couple other people for us seems inconceivable.
Yeah, you know, we had a young team in Sochi, and I was like a father figure almost there.
Right.
And but I was very happy that I was still able to play well and have a success. And, you know, usually the coaches, they never really name me as a captain because I'm still very vocal and I try to bring my things in the locker room. I'm happy and I'm very positive. So usually they always gave me an A, you know. So mm-hmm. now yeah. I got the C, and I knew it's going to be my last tournament as a in national level. And same thing, I just try to enjoy every day and make sure that everybody knows that we're going to have a good chance to win the medal here. And we played unbelievable there. Yeah.
Your career is interesting as well because, look, nobody likes living through a lockout. But that actually, that gave you a chance to heal, didn't it? Gave your body a chance to heal and kind of gave you that finishing kick. You might be one of the few players who actually,
that worked out to your
benefit, didn't it?
Absolutely. You know, the thing is, after the Colorado year, actually it started early 2000, you know, my left knee started getting worse and worse. And then the Colorado year, you know, I wasn't happy player anymore. I couldn't play the level that I used to play. And then after the World Cup, I decided, you know what, I'm going to get this knee fixed now, and it's a big surgery, and I didn't know if I'm going to play hockey again, you know. Mm-hmm. I decided I'm not going to play if I'm not 100%, and having the lockout that I didn't have to rush back, and it took like 7-8 months before I started feeling good, and maybe 9 months that I was 100%, so that gave me a chance to come back 100%, and even if it was bad for hockey, it was so important for me, because I didn't know if there would be a season that how I would felt about the whole thing. And then Brian Burke and Randy Carlyle gave me a chance to come back to Anaheim, and I got a chance to prove that I can still play well. And then I played 9 more years and I enjoyed the hockey the most.
Who would have thought, because you and Randy Carlyle at one point weren't the best of friends, were you? Or no, he was?
No, we were friends, but I guess, you know, like when I came to the league.
Yeah.
Obviously, Randy was an old-time, you know, hockey guy. And
he called you a Laplander, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, that's a good thing, you know.
Yeah.
and he has some Finnish heritage, too.
So, oh, no, okay.
Yeah, that's
all
why,
right.
That's why he called me. But
okay.
The thing is, you know, like, he thought that me and Jamino were like a normal rookies. But we're already 22 years old. We already played Canada Cup and Olympics and everything. And I think he got a little mad that we didn't stay after the practice to backskate and do certain things what rookies normally do, you know. So sometimes he got a little mad, but, you know, it was more like a friendly mad, you know. And he was just like shaking his head that, you know, and he couldn't believe what happened.
So there was no problem when he was coaching you then?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
And, you know, what a great coach, too. He's, there's no misunderstanding with Randy. He's an old school guy, and if you do what he asks, then you have never problems.
One of the things you said in your book, I sort of wrote this quote down here. I just learned how this is when you got traded. I just learned how brutal the business can be in all of this. There's no feeling between the team and the player when you're gone. You're gone. For you, is that sort of like the moment where you maybe realize like it's not a game and it's a business and you have to take care of yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that trade changed me as a person too. You know, growing up in Finland, and I started in the same organization was like 8 or 9. And you pretty much play all the way up to the top level in the same organization, and you feel so loyal for that organization, and it's almost like a family feeling. And then you come here, first you feel the competition or how hard it is, and then when I got traded, I felt that I failed. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't play well, you know, and I was so disappointed, you know, and I felt that they didn't want me. And then you realize it's just a business, you know. You're like a racehorse. As long as we run great, they keep you. And when you don't, they make sausages, you know.
It's,
So it was hard to realize that right away, but little by little you adjust those things. And Then when you realize about the business, then you can live with that. But it was something that I never could, you know, imagine that how hard it is to get traded.
You were hugely popular wherever you went with fans, with media, and especially, you know, in Winnipeg. Winnipeg's always, going back to the WHA days, it had Veli Pekka Kotola, Heksi Ruiranta. You know, they had Swedes that came over. And it seemed as if the players from Finland and Sweden embraced being in Winnipeg. You know, Winnipeg didn't necessarily seem like an outpost to them. Why do you think that is? Why was there such that an affinity there?
Well, that's a good question. I don't really know the answer for that. But obviously, a guy like for myself, it was easy to come and go there because, you know, those guys were there and there was good reputation about Finnish players and everything. And, you know, I think it's got to do something with Don Beasley too. You know,
Agent, right?
Yeah, Don was an agent for like
lovely
a lot of
man.
Finnish players and helped Ulf Nilsson and Anders Hedberg and those guys. So I think he has something to do with that as well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the city is very similar than Helsinki and what a wonderful people there is. You know, I always tell everybody how proud I am that I played those 4 years there.
You make home base now in California as well as Finland. So Anaheim is home and then back Finland is home. You have a hockey school there, I read, and one of the alumni in your hockey school is Kaapo Kakko.
Yes.
This kid looks like he is going to be an unbelievable player. What can you tell us just about his development? And was there a certain point when you knew, like, this kid has it?
Yeah, so I'm running that scoring academy for two camps every year. And they are for 16-year-old junior national team forwards. And when Kaapo came the first camp, he was ranked number 6 in our forwards. And then the following June, we had the second camp for those same guys, and he wasn't by far number 1. So that just proved that, you know, like you never know how fast they're going to grow up in the men's shoes, you know. And but this guy has all the tools, you know. He's an unbelievable kid, and I think he's struggling a little bit right now. But, you know, the thing is, I can't believe how ready these 18-year-old kids are right now coming to the NHL, and they're so ready to play right away. If I look back at when I was 18, there's no way I could come, even mentally, to come and be ready to live in this lifestyle and not even talk about playing. You know, I think these guys are unbelievable these days.
Do you ever wonder what it would have been like if you had skills coaches at the age of 14 and 15 the way these kids do now? Shooting coaches.
Yeah, you know, the training and everything, all the help that these guys are getting right now. That's why they are ready for age 18, you know. So I think it's great, and every help you can have, you know, it's a big advantage, you know. So hockey, there's a lot of good people working around hockey right now.
Do you ever wonder how you would have felt if you hadn't won the Stanley Cup to end your career?
It's a scary thought, you know, because there's a lot of moments that I was thinking that, you know, I'm never going to win. I didn't have any chance to go third round before that.
Yep.
That year when we won, you know, I was waiting 15 years to get even a chance, you know, and that's why, you know, we tried to remind each other every day that, you know what, this is the pretty much only chance we're going to get. We had guys like Chris Pronger, Robbie Niedermeyer, Todd Marchand, Sean O'Donnell, a lot of old guys that we knew this going to be the shot, you know. Then we have Getzlaf and Perry. They probably think that we're going to win 4 or 5 times.
Yeah, exactly. This is easy. It happens early in our career. We win every year.
Yeah. So when we won that year and we had an unbelievable team, when I look back, we were lucky a couple of times, and it's so hard to win in this league.
The book is Timo Salani, My Life with Ari Menander. Timo, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'll take a break and we come back. Jeff Passan joins us. We'll talk a little World Series. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Elliot Friedman joins us at 4 o'clock. He is our NHL insider. Just finishing off his 31 Thoughts podcast. Timo Salani. Great conversation with Timo Salani. Really enjoyed Timo Salani and Nicholas Lidstrom. That's pretty. You were starting a hockey team.
I feel pretty good about my hockey team with those two guys.
Pretty good about those two guys, exactly. I wonder if there are beer league teams out there that would take either of those guys on their team.
I can't get past the fact that he was 42, 43 years old, captaining a team in the Olympics. I don't think people realize how unbelievable that is in that sport.
That was my segue, by the way, to remind you that your team could be playing in a game called by Joe Bowen and Jim Ralph live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. It's the first annual Champions of Rec League Cup. You, most of you, I'm hoping by now, will have nominated your team. And if you haven't, you still have a chance to nominate your team as a wild card team. And, of course, this is an opportunity to play hockey at the Mattamy Athletic Center, have the game called on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. There will be a after party, and apparently I am wearing a mascot's outfit to raise money for charity in Hamilton.
Do you know what the mascot is?
That is yet to be determined. Shall we say that the situation as we speak is fluid?
Yeah, be careful there.
Mr. Brunt is, I've said I don't do body parts, I don't do organs, and I will only do certain vegetables.
Okay.
Mr. Brunt is serving as the go-between. Anyhow, David Jennings from Oshawa, you've nominated the team Hulk Hoagie's Cheesesteaks, which is captained by Rob Ola. If you're on the team Hulk Hoagie's Cheesesteaks, you have 590 seconds to call us at 416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, star 590 in your cell to qualify for the voting round of this contest. Again, for full contest details, go to sportsnet.ca/590. Jeff Passan's our MLB insider with ESPN. He joins us. What's up, Passan?
I am soaking wet. It was just an absolute downpour deluge here in Houston a couple minutes ago. And thank God this place is domed. Yeah, I love dome stadiums.
I know. You get to a certain point in the season and in your career where the dome stadiums, regardless of where they're located or how old they are, they do have a romance to them. They really do.
Tropicana Field has one good thing going for it, and that is the roof.
That's right. So, it's a sport of stats, and every now and then, you know, a number comes up that surprises me. Our friend Tom Verducci threw this out today, and other people have as well. But I feel bad because I had to go and check it because I did not believe, Jeff, that Justin Verlander has not won a World Series game in six starts. I just assumed he would have. Now, admittedly, I don't wake up every morning and check on him. But looking at, he hadn't won any. Don Newcomb hadn't won any. And Vida Blue hadn't won any. It just kind of reinforces how difficult the game can be, doesn't it?
Yeah, baseball's hard. When you get to the World Series, you're facing presumably, if not the best team in the opposing league that particular year, one of the two or three best teams. And, he's been facing good lineups, and that's not an excuse. I mean, there are plenty of great pitchers. There are plenty of pitchers who aren't great who have gone out there and dealt in the World Series, which is why the numbers, it's not just the 0-5 record. It's not just the winless and six starts. The ERA is like 5.79, maybe.
Yes.
I mean, it's something not good. And, what I'm looking for tonight is the first inning. Justin Verlander has had all sorts of trouble in his last two starts in the first inning. And if he can get through the first inning and allow that lineup to put a run or two on the board for him against Steven Strasburg, I think he's going to be in really good shape.
Jeff, from covering the Nationals this year and just the constitution of that group, do you think they have the resiliency to forget about the last three games and come back?
Oh, no question about it. And they've got the right guy on the mound. I mean, we talk about Max Scherzer like he's the ace of this team, and I think he is the spiritual ace. But I think if you ask anybody with some truth serum on the Nationals who's your best pitcher, they're going to say Steven Strasburg. And he's the guy who they want on the mound tonight because – if they win tonight, Game 7 is a complete crapshoot. Mm-hmm. You just have no idea what the game is going to give you at that point. They're going to have Anibal Sanchez. They're going to have Patrick Corbin. Maybe, depending on how he feels when he wakes up tomorrow, they're going to have Max Scherzer. And on the other hand, the Astros are going to have Zach Greinke on full rest, and Jose Urquidy and Garrett Cole in their mix and match five pitcher bullpen, which AJ Hinch has deployed to great effectiveness this postseason. So it almost becomes a game of the managers at that point. And that is something that's extremely rare to say in 2019 when managers in so many ways have been neutered.
Jeff, Yordan Alvarez, what changes did he make at the plate? Was it two games ago, I believe, or was it before the last game where Alex Cintron sort of pulled him aside and they reworked his stance a little bit? And how rare is that to happen at this stage of the season?
It's extremely rare, but it was extremely necessary because Yordan Alvarez was terrible for all of October, honestly, until the last couple of games. And this was a guy who, if you look at his raw numbers, was the best hitter in the American League from the time he came up to the end of the season. I mean, this guy was an absolute star, and he just disappeared. And the fact that the Astros are where they are is a testament to their depth. And look, you see that in the lineup every day. When you can start with George Springer and go Jose Altuve and Michael Brantley and Alex Bregman and Carlos Correa and Yordan Alvarez and Yuli Gurriel. I mean, we're talking about seven all-star caliber hitters there. And they're a pretty formidable lineup for any pitcher to have to go through once, twice, let alone three times like they're hoping Strasburg will tonight.
Jeff, this sort of falls under, you know, my interest in terms of media reporting, but one of the things that has struck me is the viewership of this World Series. It's really, really bad. If you look at each of the individual games, they're essentially the lowest viewership since 2014. One of the games, I think, was game four, is the lowest game four on record in terms of viewership. Fox will get a little bit, talking at least in the States, Fox will get a little bit of a break if it goes to game seven, because people just tune in for game sevens. But does this, in your opinion, say something larger about the product? Because the viewership has been really, really poor for this.
Yeah, but Richard, you know this as well as anyone. The viewership for Major League Baseball has been trending this way for a decade plus now. And this is no surprise when I understand that the Washington, D.C. market is, I think, the sixth biggest major market
include
in
Baltimore.
The U.S.
And, yeah, right.
Yep, and Houston is right behind it in terms of metropolitan area.
Yep.
And, you know, you have two pretty large markets here, but the interest in baseball outside of the parochial level just is not there. And, yeah, it's a problem. It's unquestionably a problem because these are the games that every single baseball fan should want to watch, regardless of their allegiance. And what has become clear, abundantly clear now, is that they don't. So how, if you're a Major League Baseball, do you reconcile that? And how do you reckon with it? I don't have a good answer to this. And I don't think the people at MLB do either. I almost wonder if they are resigned to the reality that right now, and for the foreseeable future, they're going to be a local game. And that's a tough thing to swallow for a game that likes to call itself the national pastime. But it's pretty clear at this point that baseball has been usurped by football there. Baseball has been usurped by the NBA. And you can make an argument has been usurped by both college and college basketball and football. And the idea that baseball is the number five sport in America is insane, but it's probably at this point truthful. And yet the people at Major League Baseball seem to be okay with this. And I think they're okay with it because franchise values have gone up exponentially, because local television contracts remain a source of huge income, and because there are still, even if attendance has gone down, more than 69 million people a year going to ballparks.
Yeah.
And that is not an insignificant number.
Yeah, it's interesting, Jeff, you know, and you know, I know you've talked about this. At some point when the revenue stream comes in from legalized gambling, that disconnect may grow even more. And I think that's what we've seen. It's almost a disconnect between, I'm going to say, the average baseball fan and baseball, because you know what? Getting your ass into the ballpark and getting you to sit down and buy beer and hot dogs and all that good stuff, or getting you to watch the game on TV nationally, just not that big a deal anymore, because they can make money other ways that, quite frankly, don't require as much of an investment on their part.
Yeah, they can, but that is such short-term thinking, Jeff.
Oh, it is. Yes, I agree. It is. But I'm saying I think that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, I agree with you. And the issue is not what's going on right now. Right now, it's perfectly fine because they're still making money. But a generation from now, when you've got, you know, the kids who are between 5 and 15 right now are not baseball fans and are neither going to the game nor watching it on television, that's where it's going to be the problem. The short-term thinking and the short-term myopia of Major League Baseball and ownership in particular is truly problematic.
Jeffrey, we're going to let you run. Enjoy the game tonight. Good stuff as always.
Pleasure is mine, boys. Have a great rest of the show.
Thanks,
Take
Jeff.
Care. Jeff Passan, our MLB insider from ESPN. Again, Nationals and Astros, 8 o'clock tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and Sportsnet. Astros looking to lock up the series. MLB Central postseason with Campbell, Siddle, and Morneau is at 7:30 p.m. First pitch just after 8 on Sportsnet Ontario. Dan Shulman, Chris Singleton with a call on the radio. Matt Vasgersian and Buck Martinez with a call on television. We will take a break and we come back. Mr. Deitch and myself will talk a little more, I think, about TV ratings in the World Series. And are we on the verge of seeing a real disconnect between fans and baseball itself? It's Writer's Block with Blair and Deitch on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Richard Deitch and myself were talking just before the break about the World Series ratings, which have been crap in the States.
Well said.
Well, they have been. Although I should point out that I remember everybody predicting that the Subway World Series between the Yankees and Mets was going to be a ratings monster.
Tanked.
It was awful as well. But, you know, Jeff Passan brought up a good point about there's so many ways to generate revenue now in sports that I think there is a real danger, if baseball isn't careful, Richard, of there being a disconnect with the fan.
Yeah, the one thing that Passan said that I think is dead on, at least in terms of someone, you know, I've written about this for a long time, is it really has, Jeff, become a regional sport, and Major League Baseball seems accepting of that because the franchise is getting so much money from these regional networks, so, you know, they're cashing out. As Passan said, franchise values are up. Where I think they have spectacularly screwed up, they're not going to change it, is in the playoffs, they made a decision to have the playoffs on so many different networks to get all these different network monies. It is very hard for your average fan to follow where the playoffs will be. And then I don't think they do a very good job, in my opinion, of marketing the World Series outside of those markets. But I think they're accepting of it because the money's still rolling in. So if the money rolls in, why do you have to change? I think they're making a long-term mistake here.
Well, it seems as if the philosophy is, it's not a crisis if we don't recognize it as a crisis, and I'm not certain that's the way to grow the game. And look, we're going to be talking about this because with the coming on board of legalized gambling, it's just going to be another reason for baseball to forget the average fan. It's, you know, something you'd like to think that the commissioner's office would be a little more aware of. Elliot Friedman's our NHL insiders with Hockey Night in Canada, the NHL on Sportsnet. Elliot Friedman joins us. It's Writer's Block on 590 and 360.
They're not afraid to put their name on it. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
A reminder, looking for a treat this Halloween? Deitch, you looking for a treat this Halloween? Elliot, you looking for a treat this
Always.
Halloween?
Yes. No candy apples, no toothpaste.
Give me Kit Kats.
Nothing like that.
What about great products like the Carbone? Would you like a Carbone?
Carbone sounds good.
How'd you like a Carbone?
Tell me what it is.
Oh, I would love me a Carbone. Well, great products like Carbone are perfect. This is an infused dough with activated charcoal that gives the pizza its signature colors from our friends at Pizza Nova. It has a lighter and airier texture with the same great Pizza Nova taste you're used to. Let Pizza Nova do the cooking for you. No trick. Just call ahead or order online at pizzanova.com. Taste the difference at Pizza Nova. We had some of that aforementioned Carboni pizza, and it's damn good.
Delicious.
And pizza's, Thank you, pizza, you know, Nova. And Halloween's like a big day for pizza, right? Because nobody really wants to cook if you're taking your kids out to...
I'm concerned it's supposed to pour.
Yeah, so that, by the way, I will say this. Halloween in New York City is big, but you have a lot of, honestly, 20 and 30-somethings who are just sort of, you know, with no responsibility, just living the Halloween dream of being drunk and just being crazy.
Wait a second, you need Halloween to do that?
Well, no, I'm saying, in Toronto, I must say, especially where I live, like, it is crazy how people are into it.
It's big.
Oh, it is.
It's great. Houses, like... docked out in like Halloween stuff.
I got to tell you.
Adults dress up.
Yeah.
It's a regional thing because I can tell you in other parts of the country, it is really no big deal. I was blown away when we moved to Hamilton. I was blown away at how much time people devote to getting their houses ready. You go to a lot of places in this country and there's nothing. I mean, basically, if you've got your light on, that means come on over. We'll give you some candy. If the light's off, it means keep on walking. Lost.
Pennies. For you.
I mean, we'll send the dog after you if you've come anywhere near our driveway.
We used to use it. I mean, we used to go out and pull tricks. Like, we'd remove manhole covers off the road.
Did you toilet paper?
No, toilet paper's lame. We take manhole covers off of roads and, serious stuff.
That's a flaming bag of poop?
That's very
flaming bag of poop.
That's hardcore, Blair. Manhole covers
off. Now, you've got young kids. Are you going out trick-or-treating this week?
We are. Yeah, I'm not dressing up.
You're not,
but they are going out. They cannot be more excited. Yeah. Like, to them.
It's big time.
What are they going out as?
One is going as a Paw Patrol character, and the other, I believe, will be going as a Blue Jay. Would you like to guess what Blue Jay player?
Marcus Stroman?
That's a pretty good guess.
Well, probably the outfit would fit.
Are they going out as the athletic trainer, Nikki Huffman, the ex-athletic trainer?
Yeah, actually, with a big sign that says, I'm in private practice now. No, my kids are, they're really excited. And again, it was because last year, like around our neighborhood. It was literally like a parade of parents and kids like out there. I was blown away. I could not believe how much people were into it in this city, which was very cool to see.
There's a house in our neighborhood in Hamilton. And I don't know how many pumpkins dude puts out front, but it's a fundraiser. You give, I think it's 20 bucks. You go over, you carve a pumpkin and it's in front of his house. And I got a picture of it from last year, but we're talking hundreds of pumpkins. Like, people from the neighborhood go by, donate your money, carve pumpkin. And I walked by his house on Saturday, and he had like one of those really long U-Haul trainers or trailers full of boxes of pumpkins.
Wow.
Just taking them out,
Elliot, forgive me for asking this.
It is a big deal.
But if I was trick-or-treating at Don Cherry's house, what do you think he would be giving me if I was a little kid?
I guarantee you he would be incredibly generous. He would spoil you with chocolate.
Yeah, a lot of chocolate, right?
You try that. We're going out as, me and my son are going out as Mario and Luigi.
I love that.
Yeah.
Who's Mario and who's Luigi?
I'm Luigi.
Okay,
he's Mario. He's big into the video game right now, so we'll see. But I bet you Don would be exceedingly generous.
Were you able to get the adult-sized costume of that?
Yes. I would like to say for the record. I got the last one at Party City.
You know what the most disappointing thing is? Having a dentist in your neighborhood on Halloween.
Oh, that's the worst.
Because they give up like bottles of water and toothbrushes.
Yeah, you know what?
If I was a dentist, I would love Halloween.
Oh, I would too. I'd be giving out like pure sugar.
Hey, wait a sec. I'm not just giving you one chocolate. I'm giving you the 80 box of chocolate.
Here's a can of maple syrup. Just drink it on the way home and see what happens.
Now, Ellie, I know your son is a little bit older than my twins. Is it the same deal? Like, we let them have a little bit of candy after they went trick-or-treating. And that was a mistake. I mean, literally, they were up to like 10:30, the latest they've ever been up in their life.
How old are your kids?
They just turned 5.
No, then you should be taking all the good candy away from them, keeping it for yourself,
and
leaving them.
It's so hard, though.
This is all you got, kids.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's so hard not to let them have something after they go out and get stuff.
No, we'll give them something.
Yeah,
you got to do that.
But it is like you do.
Steph has to deal with the outcome.
That's right.
You pay the price for that, though. Like that night, they cannot fall asleep. Anyway.
Anyhow, so we've done just about everything we can to avoid talking about the Maple Leafs. That's not true. I shouldn't say that.
By the way, Solani looks.
We're talking about that.
Looks good, eh? Puts the three of us to shame.
God almighty.
That guy, he's seriously like, the guy looks like he could still play.
Yeah.
He was 47?
You know what he looks like? He should be starring in one of those like really brooding finisher,
like a telenovela.
He could be a Bond villain.
He definitely, he could be an actor.
They just finished wrapping up the movie, I guess.
Yeah.
He could be a Bond villain.
Yeah, he's a good looking dude, but he has
acting.
But he has a presence. You know what I mean? Yes. Like he if he walked down the street, you'd look at the guy, and even if you didn't know he played hockey, you'd be like, this guy looks like somebody.
Yeah. I don't want to get into fanboy mode here, but really everybody says everybody's a good guy. He was one of the most respectful athletes for journalists to deal with.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
He really was.
Fill your notebook or your tape, whatever it is. I mean, how many interviews did he do here today? He did you.
Yeah. 31 thoughts.
He did our podcast. Yeah. I saw him with Danielle.
So he's,
I saw
digital.
Him.
Is he doing SportsCenter?
I'm sure he's doing Tim and Sidiot.
Sidiot, right?
You know, I mean, I'm at least four, probably more than that.
Yeah, anyway. Wow. He's a great player, too.
By the way,
yeah.
Lidstrom, Solani, and now Elliot Friedman.
Yeah, I know.
Three hockey Hall of Famers.
That's like two guys making a great setup and me fanning the puck in on the corner.
That's not true. Hey, you know, Alexander Ovechkin had some stuff to say today that...
that won't go anywhere.
No, it hasn't. We, of course, have been really underplaying it. I talked to Merrick about it. Merrick said, it seemed to me to sort of be a guy saying, look, this was my experience as an athlete. But, you know, when I heard it, I thought, this is a guy who is a great player. I mean, did all the great things you can do individually, but the Stanley Cup was kind of the thing, that's the thing he was pursuing. And I think he's almost... For that reason, he's almost an ideal guy in some ways to kind of relate to this situation.
I thought it was perfect. And, you know, I think sometimes guys say things like Brad Marchand would say that with a twinkle in his eye.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I just feel myself lighting the match to the Toronto market as I say this. Ovechkin, if you look at his face and you watch that whole scrum this morning, he's saying it earnestly. Yeah. He's saying, look, this is a fact. You know, and I bet you, you know, he was in the league 14 years before he won.
Yes.
You know, I bet you he would tell you that if he knew it would have been that painful in year 5 or 6, he would have changed that much sooner. But the team changed with him. Like the Capitals changed their identity and
got a different coach.
They went through several of them.
I know.
They went from Glenn Hanlon to Bruce Boudreau to Dale Hunter to Adam Oates to Barry Trotz.
Right. Yeah.
Like there were a lot of guys there. They tried a lot of guys. And first of all, it's a team sport. It's a big time team sport. But secondly, it is a reminder that you can be a tremendously skilled team, but you also have to be a team that has will. And I said this many times, like toughness isn't just punching somebody in the face. Toughness is it's 50-50 for that puck. Who's getting it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The fact is you also need some breaks. It's a long playoff, whether it's your goalie being hot, whether it's, you know, just a puck bouncing a certain way. Very rare does anybody sort of roll 4-4-4-4, you know, without any issues or without any luck. So that's one thing. The other thing, Elliot, I told this to Jeff, was that when you heard what Ovechkin said today, it comes off so much with so much more authority because he's won. And that's like the difference. Like if the exact same quote from a player, let's say, who has not won a cup, let's forget about like the goals and how Ovechkin, one of the great scorers of all time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, it's so interesting that like that stamp gives it that kind of
100%.
Authenticity. Literally, if Ovechkin says that 5 years ago, I actually think how it's played in this market is totally different.
100%.
Yeah.
And you know what? He'd be getting criticized because he hadn't won.
Exactly. Like, what do you know? Right.
How dare you say that? You haven't won anything. Yep. You know, keep your mouth shut. But now, because he's won, it's got weight.
Yeah. What? Do you believe it?
Yeah, I do. You know,
I don't mean to be. I'm not asking it as an asshole. I'm just saying, do you believe? Do you believe that it's just simply a matter of, well, we all got to play together and.
I think also like, look, like, you know, I talked about this last week. I think on the morning show, the toughest thing about paying your youngest players, and this is the way hockey's going now, like, you know, Roman Josi signed an 8-year deal today.
Yeah.
At 74, 72 million bucks or whatever it is. And people are like, are you nuts? You're giving this guy an 8-year contract that starts when he's 30. And that's the reaction to the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're in a sport where everybody thinks the right thing to do is to pay guys when they're 20, 21, and pay them lots of money with no understanding of are they really capable of handling it. Like, I see a group of players right now. I think they're entrusted with all this responsibility. They are great players. I think they will get to be even great, better players. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they really... I want to say this in a way that doesn't get me radioed. I just don't think you have any clue, really, how hard it is to win and what you need to do to get there yet. You don't have 100% clue. I think these guys have a better understanding now of how hard it is because they've been knocked out three times in the first round. But still, like, if you win one round, as you said, Richard, there's no guarantee you're winning a second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it gets harder and harder and harder. And, like, I just think all these guys, Matthews, Marner, Nylander, they are learning how freaking hard it is to win in this league. And because they're all making a ton of money and because they all had very public contract situations and a couple of them turned really nasty, the public's patience with them is less. So they may need to learn and they may have a lot to learn, and I think they will learn it. But I think, you know, and I think I'll tell you this. I think there's another problem right now. I think the Raptors winning has really ratcheted up the pressure.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
I was about.
I think it has 100% changed. They were fun. They won. And now here we are. And I think it's made it harder for these guys.
I think that's well said.
Really good point.
They, you know, and even if you look at it sort of economically, look at that parade. Look at the faces in that crowd. Different ethnicities, different ages.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying the Leafs are not going to have an issue in terms of selling tickets or stuff. But, you know, if you're a Leafs management and you look out there, like, that was a movement. I'm not saying it's gonna last.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're right. I think that changed the game in terms of the perception just of the sports fan in this city. And, like, this is, wow, this could happen.
Well, now they set a bar.
Yeah, like, literally, yes. Like, you can get a championship here. Like, it can be done. Mm-hmm. And almost you can make the argument it can be turned around in a year, which is what Masai Ujiri sort of did. It's not to say they weren't a good team, but the leap that they made was dramatic.
I think it's hard to sell slow and steady with a salary cap team in a city where people have seen a general manager come in, blow the works up, and win.
And be bold.
And be bold. Mm-hmm. And
Kawhi said, the other thing too is, and I think this Babcock's talked about it, he set an extremely high standard.
Yeah.
Like, and like when he was here, all he did was his job. Mm-hmm. What do you need me to do? I'm going to do it. There was no drama.
Mm-hmm.
He set a high standard every day. Win or lose, he played hard. He practiced hard. He competed hard. And there was no drama.
Yeah.
The drama was after it was all over.
Right.
But who cared? Like, some people get upset at that. I mean, he came and he won.
You know, one thing, Jeff, and Ellie, I just want to say, because we had Lidstrom on today, I realize that they are different people, different. You can't even necessarily compare them athletically in terms of positioning. But the one characteristic that both Nick Lidstrom and Kawhi Leonard have is dependability.
Yeah,
every single night, you know what you're getting. And you are probably
going to get... Unless load management's in effect.
It's a good job, Blair. That's
true. But that's not on Kawhi. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, when Kawhi played, Kawhi was remarkably
consistent.
You're
basically getting, as you said, Elliot, you're getting excellence with no drama every night.
Yeah.
And if you can pencil that in any sport, put you in a whole different place.
Hey, I think that's one of the reasons that made Michael Jordan great, was that you could be playing the Clippers, who if you're thinking of the Clippers now, right, back then they were a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And you could be playing the Clippers back in February of game 47 of a brutal season, and he'd think up of a reason why he wanted to kill them. Oh, that guy looked at me the wrong way in college. I'm going to destroy him.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that, and I think these play like, I do believe, and Chris Johnston talked about it a bit on Saturday night during our headline segment, I think there is a segment of the organization that thinks it's not the worst thing that they're all going through this. Now, it's the worst thing if they miss the playoffs.
They don't come out of
or it's a bad thing if they get knocked out in the first round again. But, you know, I think sometimes, and I'm speaking from personal experience because I've been through it, you kind of have to go through the meat grinder to make yourself better, right? And this is the first time since these guys got to Toronto where they're kind of going through the meat grind.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Now, Nylander went through it a bit last year with his contract situation, but now these guys are going through the meat grinder. And I think the challenge is, can you come out of it better? And I just believe in their talent that I think eventually they will come out of it better.
No, I'm with you completely, and that's really well said, because even when Nylander came back after his holdout, whatever you want to call it, his contractual impasse, by that point we were well into the season and there were in-season things to worry about. So yeah, there was focus on him, but there was a lot of other stuff to worry about. Got to get to the playoffs and things of that nature. But for the longest time, hockey fans in this city, Elliot, and you know this as well as anybody, it's not that they didn't like the Leafs, but they weren't exactly the most embraceable group of athletes around. All of a sudden, they have a group that I think are pretty embraceable, and that works for 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But when the guys down the street win and you haven't been able to get over that first hurdle, at some point, it comes around 180 degrees, and people start saying, okay, it's cute, we're glad you like it here, but you got to start performing.
Well,
we're at that stage right now.
That's Ovechkin. Like the two standard bearers of this generation are Crosby and Ovechkin. Crosby goes to the Cup in his third season, 07-08.
Right.
They lose in 6 games to Detroit. He wins the Cup in his fourth year. And then before they win again in 16, how much did he go through?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember interviewing him at the Olympics in Sochi asking, how come it's so hard to find guys to play with you? Oh, man, I get in trouble for that one. But and not from him. But and Ovechkin, when he first came in, we were talking about he won the Calder over Crosby, the joie de vivre. Oh, yep. We love. But then it changed. Like, this guy doesn't play defense.
That's true.
He's the reason the Capitals are losing. The year before they won the Stanley Cup, we were all asking, are they going to trade him? After they lost again to Pittsburgh. So, unfortunately, I think for a lot of great players, there is that natural progression of, we love you. Oh, you're not that good. And then if you win, we love you again.
It's a bigger issue for this team, because there seems to me there's two sort of trains of thought right now. One is that the team needs help defensively. Travis Dermott's coming back tonight. I don't know if that necessarily makes a difference defensively, but there's a lot of concern about the number of shots they're giving up, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The other is Austin Matthews needs to change somehow, that there has to be some sort of a different approach on the part of Austin Matthews. Either of those valid arguments from your point of view in explaining where we are right now?
Well, I think they will be better when Dermott and Hyman and Tavares are back.
Like, right.
I don't think that makes me an insider.
No.
That's just freaking smart. But, yeah. The Matthews thing, I think it's really interesting. I look at Matthews and, if you look at Babcock, and I haven't checked the numbers, but last week when I looked at them, I think he'd taken like 12 defensive zone draws all year. And Gauthier was in the 60s and Shore was in the 60s. Now, I understand it from a tactical point of view. I mean, they're better face-off guys, and they were over 60%, and Matthews was at like 30. And in the Columbus game a week ago yesterday, he got beat off a D-zone draw for a goal. But at the end of the day, I just believe the way this team is stacked up and the way they are in the cap, if we're going to talk about Matthews, an elite 200-foot center, and this isn't just talk, you got to throw him in the deep end
mm-hmm.
until he learns to deal with it. Like, it's going to be tough. He's going to have nights like that night where the Blue Jackets take it by him and score. But how do you get better? The only way you get better is if you get thrown out. Okay, Austin, they scored on you. Now, in practice, you're going to work on your technique. You're going to watch film, and we're going to put you out there and challenge your own personal pride to get better. I would love to see a 20 to 25 game stretch at least where they commit themselves to that. And I think that's the only way you can improve is by going out there and doing it and maybe get your clock cleaned once in a while. But if you're determined to get better, you will.
Elliot, when I saw you coming in today, I wanted to just ask you a quick question about philosophy.
Yeah.
Which favorite philosopher?
Voltaire?
Voltaire? Are you a Kirk Muller guy or a Kierkegaard guy?
Kierkegaard? Kirk Muller is such a good
I player. Would take Kirk Muller over Kierkegaard.
I've used that line before, by the
way. Yeah, I'm not surprised. So now you've thrown me off, Blair. I had a really good question. So I'm curious. I understand it's a cap league.
Yeah.
That you have to sort of figure out what to do with your dollars. But it strikes me that the league-wide, there's a devaluing of the backup goaltender in terms of dollars given to backups. I don't know if every team does this. I feel like
I don't know if I would.
Okay.
No, I don't.
So I guess maybe I'm being very parochial in terms of the leaps. But what I was trying to get at is, in other sports, at the key position, there's an investment in dollars in the backup. And I wondered, league-wide, shouldn't backup goaltenders sort of be given their financial due?
Well, I think you're seeing that more and more now. You know, I mean, if you're the backup goalie, you have to understand you're not going to make a ton.
Right.
But I think you're seeing teams say, we've got to have money for these guys. Like, you look at a guy like Jaro Halak, he's got a pretty high salary for a backup goalie, and he's worth it. I think he started 27 times last year, and it was a major reason the Bruins went to the Stanley Cup final. You know, I have thought a lot about this whole situation with Hutchison, and is Babcock doing the right thing? And, you know, this is the first year that's really blown up in their face so far.
Mm-hmm. But you don't think last year did with Sparks a little bit?
Well, it did, but, you know, yeah, I guess you're right. He played himself out of a job. But generally, it had worked pretty well up until... This is a recent phenomenon
right.
for the Maple Leafs in terms of how it's worked. The one thing is, like, with the cap situation they have and where they are, this is where they are. Especially the fact they're in long-term injury the whole year. And I'm 100% convinced they're out there looking to see what are the better opportunities. But if it's a guy who makes a ton of money, unless or for a backup... They don't have a lot of room to fit.
Good of you to do this, sir. Thanks so much.
No problem. Good to be in.
Elliot Friedman of Hockey Night in Canada and Sportsnet. When we come back, the voice of the Toronto Raptors, Matt Devlin, will join us. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and 360. A reminder, Nationals and Astros, 8 o'clock tonight, Game 6 of the World Series on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and Sportsnet. Apparently, or so the story goes, Max Scherzer gave reporters the verbal thumbs up today when he was asked how he felt. So that would indicate that Max Scherzer will be available to go, one would think, Game 7 if necessary. And so we'll wait to see. I don't know. I can't imagine that if push came to shove, they would necessarily use him tonight. But there you go. Max Scherzer indicating that he is ready to pitch. I plugged this a little earlier in the show. I got a pair of tickets to give away to tonight's Leafs Washington Capitals game at Scotiabank Arena. And if you can make it to the game tonight, be the fifth caller through right now to win. The numbers are 416-870-0590, star 591, 888-666-0590. Fifth caller through will be sending you to see the Leafs and Capitals tonight at Scotiabank Arena. You get to see Alexander Ovechkin and the Capitals take on the Toronto Maple Leafs. The Raptors have the day off. They will play Dwayne Casey and the Detroit Pistons tomorrow night at Scotiabank Arena. Matt Devlin is the Raptors play-by-play voice on Sportsnet. Matt Devlin joins Richard Deitch and myself in Writer's Block. Hello, Mr. Devlin.
How are you two doing today?
We are doing well. So let me ask you that. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Grange, and I got kind of a chuckle, and then I got an answer out of him. But we're still trying to figure out how Nick Nurse is going to use his bench this year, and we're still working mm-hmm. through that process.
I think he is as well.
He is as well, which is fine. But it seems to me that it's going to come down to a matter of trust in a lot of ways. And Matt, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Mike. What does a player have to do to earn Nick Nurse's trust? Like, what do you have to do to get his attention and make him think, okay, I like what you're doing. I'll give you a chance.
Well, I think the best thing that happened early on, and this is what now 2 weeks ago, maybe a little bit longer, where Nick came out and said exactly what you have to do, and that is know the schemes and play defense, right? Know the defensive schemes, coverages, and play D. And then I think as far as who it boils down to, Patrick McCaw, as we know, last night was the eighth player. I would expect that he would be that eighth player. And as we've talked about before, there is a search for that 8, 9, 10 and who that will be. But ultimately, it's been set in stone. If you know the schemes, if you play hard, you know, defensively, then you'll earn his trust, and then the offensive piece of that will come. And that comes from getting out in transition, easy buckets. I think that that's important. And then I'll specifically mention one player, like a player like Norman Powell. His shot's not right now going, but yet, you know, playing hard defensively, knows the schemes, so he's going to have that trust level right now.
Matt, it's four games in. And the answer to this question is probably heading in the future. But do you think there's an identity yet for this group, or do you still think we're, you know, 5 to 10 to 15 games away from answering that question?
Well, I think the identity, just like last season, was in, as I just mentioned, the D, right? This is as much as everybody talks about offense in today's day and age. This was a team that got it done on most nights defensively. And when you look at defensive field goal percentage, even with the possessions that are way up in the NBA, they're still a team that can lock you down and guard. And so I think that that's where the identity is. Now, specifically the emergence of players from an individualistic standpoint, right? Last year you knew it was Kawhi. I think this season, you know, it's going to be Pascal and Kyle and maybe more of a group effort. That's from an offensive standpoint. But from a defensive standpoint, I think that that's where the identity lies.
You know, Matt, it seems as if, again, as Richard would say, it's early days and everything.
Yeah.
But one of the guys who seems to have been really energized is Serge. And noticeably, I thought in the first couple of games, how does his role change now with Kawhi not here? And whose role do you think is impacted? And I'm talking about strategically here as well. Whose role is impacted the most by Kawhi's absence?
Well, OG Anunoby certainly goes
sure.
up, right? And how great has he played early on, specifically yep. on the defensive end? And then also, you know, shooting the basketball has certainly been key and great to see. So you see that emergence. You see Norman Powell also getting, you know, more minutes without Danny Green being there. Fred VanVleet starting, right, in the absence of Danny Green. And really it's Fred as the point, and Kyle plays off the ball at the two. And so with respect to Serge, Serge is a pro's pro, and I'll say this. When you go back to last season and you trade for a player like Marc Gasol, and you're having a career year, I mean, second most points average, second in rebounding in his career, was having a stellar campaign. And then all of a sudden you say, look, I've been in the league a while. Went to the 2009 NBA Finals with Oklahoma City, never went back despite the fact that everybody thought we'd be going back. And here we are. And you face, you know, your legacy. And he wanted to win it all. And he was willing to take a secondary role in this regard, coming off of the bench. But wasn't secondary because, as we all know, without him against Philadelphia, you would, even with that shot, he had 17 points in Game 7. And the Raptors would not have advanced to the Eastern Conference Finals. Why? Because you had the ability to play big and play both Serge and Mark together, which we've already, through the first four games, seen more of that. So his role doesn't necessarily change because it's the presence of Mark. His minutes have been right around what his minutes have been in the past. But he is somebody that shows up every single night, gives you a great effort. As we know, he's a rim protector. It's something that Nick Nurse talks about a lot. needing that in today's NBA. OG Anunoby has become that as well. So that's, you know, Serge, I credit Serge. I credit a lot of players, actually, in the Raptors locker room. It was a true selfless act that a lot of players just stood up and said, you know what, together we're going to accomplish something that none of us have accomplished. This group certainly hasn't accomplished before. And while for some they had accomplished it in San Antonio, they wanted to prove that they didn't necessarily need Pop or the San Antonio silver and black to win it all. So there was a lot of selflessness in that group.
Matt, do you enjoy the throwback jerseys last night?
Yeah, I did. I liked them.
I liked them too. Yeah, I like the changeup. So the win so far, Pelicans, Magic, and Bulls. Yeah. And so my thought here is that you're not really gonna figure out where you are until you play the Bucks. But as Jeff was saying early on, you know, I'm not very high on the East. I have league pass. So I watch a lot of NBA, and I gotta tell you, like, the West is great, and the East is winnable. So I don't know how to judge at the moment the three wins for the Raptors outside of the fact that, like Jeff, I'm a big Magic fan. I think they're long, and I think they're an up and coming team. So I feel like the Bucks are maybe gonna be the first game where I get a sense of what this group is.
Well, I don't disagree with that, and I would also say that the Boston game was a winnable game.
Yeah, agreed.
Boston, I was not impressed by. In fact, and for everyone that, you know, had them, you know, as, you know, one of the top three teams in the East, I don't see that as of yet. I certainly think watching Philadelphia that they've been, you know, a team that with their pieces is one of those teams. I think Milwaukee, to your point, you'll gauge where the Raptors are against those two teams, right? Milwaukee and Philadelphia. It just so happened against Boston that they took 30 more shots.
Yeah.
You had 10 offensive fouls. You had 21 offensive rebounds. I mean, nothing was going the Raptors' way. Part of that controllable, maybe part of it not controllable. But I didn't walk away from there going, oh, wow, you know, Boston's one of those teams. So I do agree with you that on Saturday night you'll get a sense of, you know, who the Raptors can be. I think you'll get that tomorrow night, too, against Detroit. We know, you know, that Dwayne Casey last year was 3-0 against the Toronto Raptors. And, you know, it was something that, you know, certainly sensed that it was personal, right?
Mm-hmm.
With his reaction. So, you know, it's going to be a hard fought game tomorrow. But then the one that you do circle is Saturday night in Milwaukee. It gives you a sense of who the Raptors may be, and maybe it gives you a sense of who the Milwaukee Bucks will be.
Mr. Devlin, great of you to join us as always. Thank you, my friend.
Hey, my pleasure. Anytime.
All righty. That is Matt Devlin,
Matty D,
voice of the Raptors.
Love Matt Devlin.
Raptors, our next Raptors game, I should say. Mr. Deitch, you did give it a nice plug, is against the Bucks Saturday on Sportsnet 1, and that will be a bit of a measuring stick. And I'm with you guys. As someone who kind of going into the year, I thought the Celtics were a team that was poised to make some inroads given what had happened here. And maybe I admit that I'm sort of assuming that not having Kyrie Irving around is going to make them a lot better. I've seen them play a couple of times now. I've caught a bit of Philadelphia. I'm much more bullish in Philadelphia than I am I am in Boston.
I think Ben Simmons is better, and that's scary.
Yeah.
If you're a Raptors fan.
Yeah, and I think that I like the parts in Philadelphia better, but I also, I'm dead serious. I think Orlando, by the time the playoffs roll around, Orlando's going to be a team that people don't want to meet.
I agree.
In the first round. I
think I am with you on Orlando, except I think I'm 1 year behind you. I think next year is the year that it clicks, but I would not want to play them in the playoffs.
No. They've got enough length that they can make stuff interesting for you. We'll take a break. Be back with more Writer's Block on 590 and 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to Writer's Block. Man, oh man, my earpiece here is just. Right.
I was going to bring us back from break, something I never do.
All right, go ahead, bring us back.
Well, no, you brought us back already.
No, you bring us back.
But you're the professional host.
No, I'm not. You bring us back.
I just did. Back on Rider's Block. Just a couple minutes left in the show, everybody.
You don't say that.
So, you don't say that?
No.
You never give up the time?
No.
Why is that? What's the reason?
This is stupid. Because basically you're saying to
pick up, leave.
Yeah, leave.
No, you can stick around for Tim and Sid. So
that's good. Now that's good.
Is that good?
That's a good crossover. There you go.
So
1 point for Deitch.
All right. So I want to ask you Ding. This. I want to ask you this, Jeff, because I know your love for baseball. And Passan brought this up. He seemed very convincing that the series, that the Nationals absolutely can come back. They have their resilient group, and maybe they win Game 6. I'm not sure I see that, but let's say the Nationals end up winning tonight. Would you consider the Astros to then have significant pressure on them given what has occurred before, or is it Game 7 you go for the best starter, and in that case the Astros would have a big advantage.
I don't think there's any pressure in Game 7. I mean, if you want to look at it that way, if you're the Washington Nationals, you're one game away from winning the first World Series in a bazillion years. So there would probably be more pressure on the Nationals than on the Astros. The Astros don't win. Well, we still got a World Series. We're still probably going to be together next year. I'm not a believer in like the whole anything to do with momentum or anything in baseball, because it just doesn't exist. There's no such thing as momentum.
Do you believe it in other sports?
No. I believe it in, I shouldn't say no, I don't believe in football.
Hockey,
because it's a game. Hockey and basketball are games of flow.
I think.
Yeah,
so.
I can see that. Football, I don't. The idea that because I gave up a 30-yard pass in the first quarter, I'm somehow it's going to be rolling around in the back of my mind in the fourth quarter. Nah, I don't.
I agree.
I don't pay any.
Games are so different week to week in football that I don't think there's momentum.
Yeah, I also think at this point in baseball, look. At the World Series, you've seen the same team. If you're going to seven games, it'll be this. You've seen the same team six times. You've seen the same pitchers probably four or five times. You've seen the same hitters six times. Like at that point, I don't really think there's pressure on anybody at that point. Or if there is, if you want to view this pressure, I think it's equally on teams. To me, the only pressure right now in baseball is a team that has to win or go home. I mean,
if that's the case, then the Nationals have a lot of pressure on them.
But, I mean, it doesn't, is pressure going to make Steven Strasburg throw the ball differently?
No.
Probably not.
Pressure situations might, but not the pressure of elimination.
Yeah, I don't know if pressure. I mean, Steven Strasburg's pitched in some pressure-filled situations. So I just don't. Baseball's such an odd sport because it's the one sport where the defense has possession of the ball, right? It's a negative sport. It's the only sport where the first play is me trying to prevent you from doing something.
That's interesting.
Everything else, you're trying to score.
Yeah.
The first play in baseball is I'm the pitcher. I don't want you to do anything. So that's why I think that, the old saw that momentum in baseball is the next day's starting pitcher is probably right. If you've won three games in a row and you've got a piece of crap going in game four, guess what? You probably aren't going to win game four.
The other thing I wanted to get your opinion on, because we didn't have a chance to talk about this, was Tiger Woods became, I guess, the all-time winningest golfer in terms of titles, not majors. How significant is that as an achievement? The reason why it's impressive to me.
Completely irrelevant.
Why do you say that?
Because he's a golfer.
Well, and again, I'm not a big golf guy at all, but I do.
What was the name of the tournament he won? Wasn't it the East-West Chess North-South Classic or something like that? It was like a make-believe tournament, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Make-believe tournament.
The one thing about that guy, though, is there was.
You may have noticed, not a big golf guy.
No, this show is no longer golf. The one thing about Tiger Woods, though, is I really did believe a couple years ago that it was over. Like, literally, his career was done. And even this late comeback, Jeff, it has been incredibly impressive to see him this competitive again.
The guy's had like 100 chances to win.
Yes.
There is no sport that gives you more chances to win. Like, this is why I don't find it that's why I don't find it that impressive. He I mean, how many events has he entered this year?
I don't know, 13 or something like that?
Yeah, it's not like, you know.
I know, but
I mean,
still,
you keep doing it long enough, you're going
to
win.
But he's 82 victories in golf. To me, that's a big number. I mean, past Sam Snead, the greatest golfer of all time. Again, I'm not a big golf guy, but like I
will say this about Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods said something after that win.
The Wozo win.
that whatever the hell it was, the East Westchester North South Classic, or East Westchester North South Classic,
right?
Whatever it was, that to me separates him from anybody else who has ever golfed. He talked about how he thought it was significant that he won a tournament in Japan because he said, "I've always considered myself an international golfer," and I will say that about Tiger Woods, the boldness of Tiger Woods in terms of what he was willing to do. Whatever you may think about Tiger Woods' background or his personality or his legal issues or marital issues, whatever, Tiger Woods was and still is a bold athlete.
Agreed.
And I will give him that. And Tiger Woods was and still is somebody who and I think that showed you something. And maybe because he's getting older and at the end of his career now, he's starting to realize just how significant an international figure he was. And when I heard him say that, to me that is huge.
I like that.
He's still a golfer.
Yeah. The only thing I would say to sort of conclude on my part is he's the only golfer of my lifetime who was able to get non-golf fans interested in golf. And I don't think we're going to see that again.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
None of these Rory McIlroy types. Nah. No one cares outside of the golf world. I get if you're a golfer, you care. But he's the only one. He's the only one who crossed people over. And I don't think, certainly not in our lifetimes, Jeff, I don't think we're going to see that again.
He is the one golfer in my lifetime, and I'm not going to get into an argument of what is an athlete or who is an athlete, who is an athlete, but he is the one golfer in my lifetime that you cannot, I mean, it is indisputable that he is a great athlete.
Absolutely.
It is, you can't, whether you like him or don't like him or like the sport or don't like the sport, you cannot look anybody in the eye and say Tiger Woods is not a great athlete. Tiger Woods is one of the greatest athletes of all time.
Yep.
There's no doubt about it.
Walked by him once and he was jacked. He looked like a guy who could have played another sport.
Yeah, as I said, he's one of the reasons I think that he had such crossover potential and such allure is because he was an athlete.
Yep.
Agreed. You could not argue that, you know, without looking like a complete idiot.
Totally agree.
So, speaking of complete idiots, I managed to get through the 3 hours of only making myself look like an idiot once. I said a bad word about it.
I did, but anyway, it was so quick.
I take it back. I meant it, but I take it back. For Deitch and Blair, I'm Jeff Blair. This has been Writer's Block. Sportsnet 590 The Fan at 360. Tim and Sid are next. Don't go anywhere.